1 John 4:20 through 5:12, the 16th talk in a series on John's letters, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 8, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Those of us who are children of God, what makes us a child of God, as we saw in section 3, for example, is that we embody that which a commitment to those values that make up the very nature and being of God himself. In the case of section 3, that was righteousness. The children of God are righteous just as their Father is righteous. The children of God, we saw in the last section, are committed to love because God is love. So throughout this section, he's defining the children of God as those people who, in the commitments of their heart, in the vision that has captivated how they want to live their life and what they want their life to be all about, they have taken all that God is as the standard by which that they want to guide their life. The brother, the child of God, is the one who's committed to righteousness. He's committed to truth. He's committed to justice. He's committed to mercy. He's committed to compassion. He's committed to love in all of its forms. And if a person is not committed to those things, then they're not a child of God, John is saying. Well, why then should we love the brethren if we love God? Because the brothers, by definition, by virtue of how he's defined who they are people who have loved who God is. And loved who God is in a way that who God is beginning to make an impact and leave an imprint on their life. The choices they make, their priorities, their value system, all that's been transformed by their love of who God is. Well, what John is saying is, how can I love who God is when I'm faced with a flesh and blood person who loves and is committed to all who God is, and I hate him for it? I despise him for his commitment to righteousness and his commitment to love and his commitment to mercy and compassion and justice and truth and all that. If I hate him for the very things that make God who God is, who am I kidding when I say I love God? Who do I think I'm kidding? Probably what's behind this is that these false teachers that John is writing this letter in response to are probably in some way making some kind of an appeal in their credentials for how much they love God. I don't know any other reason for John to be bringing up this issue in this particular way at this time, unless he's responding to something in the historical situation. Why all of a sudden are you making a big deal about who is it that loves God? Probably because that's what these false teachers are claiming. We love God. Emulate us, trust us, listen to us, let us disciple you because we love God. And John is calling their bluff. John is saying, well, wait a minute. I've watched you. I've heard rumors. I've heard reports about how you're interacting with the people in the church. And those brothers who do love God, you hate. So how can you be making a credible claim to love God whom you have never seen when in fact you hate the people who do know God and love God? That doesn't make any sense. In the last section, he just alluded to this argument. He didn't develop it like he does in this paragraph, but in one statement in the last section, he alluded to that argument. And remember there he said, no one has beheld God at any time. I think he means that absolutely. I might be wrong, but I think he means that absolutely. No one has ever at any time seen God. And I don't remember if I commented last week on this or not, but I think what he's saying is, God, for who he is in and of himself, as he is in and of himself, no human creature will ever be face to face with God. Not now, not in the past, and not in the future. You know, I think the Sunday school Christianity that most of us grew up with our conception of eternity or heaven or the final age was that we were going to go and be with God. And, you know, we could pick clover with him and smell the roses with him and all kinds of things with God, and we would walk side by side with God. And I think our image is probably informed by the Garden of Eden, where it says God came down and walked with them. Well, I think even in the Garden of Eden, that was a metaphor. You know, that how can any human creature transcend their creatureliness such that they can be a peer of the transcendent God, who is not a creature, who is not finite, who's not limited in time and space, who may not even be in time and space? How could we ever be with God in that sense and behold his face and behold him and know him and see him? I think that's what John is getting at when he says no one has beheld God at any time. So how is it that we can ever concretely and tangibly confront the very being and character of God? Only when the being and character of God takes on a form in which we can understand it. I think I did mention last week in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, John writes, there's another time where John says, no one has beheld God at any time. This is Jesus speaking, then he says, the Son whom God has sent, he has, and then the word is the Greek word for exegesis, interpretation, he has interpreted him to us. That is, Jesus is the human creature, as Paul puts it in Colossians, the visible image of the invisible God. He is the translation of that which is completely incomprehensible to us, the character of God, the translation of the character of God into a form that we can relate to, into a form that we can understand, into a form that we have access to. We can know what it means to be a good human being. So if we want to know the character of God, we look at the character of Jesus. Is he or is he not good? If Jesus is good, then the God of whom he is the incarnation is good. Well, we are not the incarnation of God in the world, but we're the next best thing as children of God. We are a group of sinners, wicked, depraved sinners, who nonetheless have been captivated by the desire and the longing to be like God. And out of that desire and longing to be like God, our whole worldview, our belief system, our value system, everything has been transformed by that. And we are beginning to show forth some to the world, some of what God is and some of who God is. How, therefore, another person responds to people like you and me who are beginning to embody those commitments and those values is a litmus test for whether or not they love the God whose lives we are committed to emulating. That's what he's talking about in this section. Now, with that as having said that, let me back up for a second and talk about what's going on in this section as a whole. He's not going to tell us much new in section 6 here. He's not going to tell us much new that he hasn't already explored in section 3, 4, and 5. We have seen as a litmus test whether or not we love the brother is an indication of whether or not we're going to inherit eternal life. We've seen that twice. Saw that in section 3, saw that again in the last section, section 5. That's not new. He's actually develops it more fully in this section, but the idea has already been presented. The next section the next issue he's going to bring up is, do you believe that Jesus is the Messiah? We've seen that before. I mean, that's been everywhere throughout this whole letter. So that's not new. I think there's really only two things in this section that are new. One is, whereas in all the previous sections, he has raised the issue of who will inherit eternal life by answering the question, who is a child of God or who is of the truth? This is the first time that he explicitly addresses the question, who is it that can make a valid claim to love God? So everything in the section seems to be centered around that question, who loves God? And he says, well, the one who loves the brother is the one who loves God. And as I said, I think there's a reason in the historical background for why he revisits the whole question of who will inherit eternal life in those terms, centered on that question of who loves God, probably because of the claims of the false teachers. The second thing that he's going to bring up is the degree to which God himself has directly, explicitly, and dramatically testified to the fact that Jesus is the Messiah in the world. And he's going to explore that. And that's new. He hasn't done anything like that anywhere else in the letter yet. So as we come into this next section, we'll see that. Okay, going on then to paragraph 35. Indeed, this is the love of God. And here I think he makes a transition to the next criteria. Indeed, this is the love of God, that we keep his instruction. Now, his instructions are not overly demanding, because everything that is fathered by God has victory over the world. I'm going to tweak my translation here a little bit. But I think this is a transition, because he says, indeed, this is the love of God, that we keep his instruction. Very simple argument here. That is, again, how can you make a valid claim to love God and disregard everything that he has taken pains to reveal to the world about what's true? John is just saying it doesn't make any sense that you would be someone who loved God, but you ignore everything he said to you. That doesn't make any sense. So this is the love of God, that we keep his instruction. Now, as we've seen elsewhere in the letter, he's talked about that before. There are really two instructions that John pinpoints at various times. The first one is that we love the brother. That was the explicit teaching of Jesus. He explicitly taught us that if we are his children, his disciples, we will love one another as disciples. So we are disregarding his teaching in that regard if we don't love one another. And then the other thing that John pinpoints as the instruction is that Jesus came into the world teaching us that he was the Messiah and that we must believe in him. Well, he's just finished saying we need to love one another. That was his instruction. If we love God, we're going to keep that instruction. Now he's going to go on to talk about the other instruction that's important. Jesus is the Messiah, and we need to believe in him. So this is a transition to that next one, the next instruction. But let me comment on this sentence here. Indeed, this is the love of God, that we keep his instruction. Now his instructions are not, I've translated overly demanding, but what he goes on to say is, because everything, and let me translate that child, because he's obviously talking about people here. I don't know why I translated everything. Child makes more sense. Because every child that is fathered by God has victory over the world. What's implicit in what he's saying here is, it is in fact the case that we as human beings are going to find the instructions of God impossible to us if we are left to ourselves. If we are just plain old ordinary citizens of this world, we are not going to love who God is, and we are not going to accept his son, the Messiah. That's just a given. We hate God, we're hostile to God, we hate everything that God is about, everything that God stands for, and everything that God is. And when he sends his son into the world, we hate him because of association with God. You know, you have that parable that Jesus told. This was with respect to the Jews, but it could equally have been told with respect to the world, where the owner of a vineyard sends messengers to the people that are working the vineyard, and they kill them. And finally, in the end, he sends his very own son, and they kill him too. I mean, that's the story of mankind, humanity's relationship to God. We have nothing but animosity toward the creator and author and owner of this world. Nothing but animosity toward him. That's our inherent nature. And we as human beings have built a whole culture around that hatred of God. And that culture is what John calls the world. The ideas that we teach one another, the instruction we give one another, the values we impart to one another, everything is ultimately founded on this hatred of God, our animosity toward God. So if all we are citizens of this world, and God comes along through Jesus and says, I'm the Messiah, believe in me, practice righteousness because your Father is righteous and all that he came to teach us, we have no use for it. We don't believe it. We don't find it workable. We don't find it practical. We don't find it plausible. We don't even find it interesting because it doesn't jibe with what we as citizens of the world are already committed to. But John's point is, but the instructions of God are not out of reach to human beings because they're human beings. They're out of reach to human beings because they're citizens of this world. But the fact is, God has had victory over the world. How do you put it? Every child that is, we have had victory over the world by virtue of the fact of a supernatural work of God to make us his children. God has fathered us. So what does he mean by God has fathered us, except God has invisibly, intangibly, secretly, if you will, invaded my very heart and transformed the commitments of my heart so that I don't think any longer like I used to think. I don't think like the culture of this world thinks any longer. I don't see the world the way the world sees it. I don't value what the world values. All that's changing as I am becoming a child of God. Well, because I'm a child of God, John says, we have victory over the world. The lies of the world and the seductive power of the world has not kept me captive. I have broken out. I've broken free. I've broken loose from the groupthink of the world, and I can think for myself now. I can see reality the way that it really is, the way that is true, because I am no longer in its grip. I have had victory. Now, why have I had victory? Not because I am powerful, not because I'm clever, but because God has fathered me, because God in his power has come and worked a supernatural miracle to transform me. It's like what Jesus said to Nicodemus, talking about those who will inherit the kingdom of God must be born either again or from above. I prefer from above. Must be born from above. They must be born from the Spirit. And the Spirit is like the wind, he says. You don't know where it's coming from or where it's going. All you can do is see the effect. That's what we see in our lives. I can't tell you why I now see life and reality the way I see it, why it makes sense to me when it didn't used to. All I know is over the course of time, one day what the Bible said was true began to ring true. It began to make sense. I began to see it. I began to get it. And Jesus was telling Nicodemus, that's because the wind of the Spirit has been blowing. You can't put it in a bottle. You can't make it a formula. You can't turn it into a technique. You're never going to be able to make that happen in anybody else's life as you learn the secrets to unleashing the power of the Spirit. The Spirit does what the Spirit wants to do. And if the Spirit wants you to see, you'll see. If the Spirit wants you to have eyes to see and ears to hear, you'll have eyes to see and you'll have ears to hear, because the Spirit is going to work in his own sovereign way. But because the Spirit works in his own sovereign way, we have had victory over the world, and the lies of the world and the deceptions of the world and the seductive power of the world no longer has power over us. So we can find ourselves having an affinity for the brothers, an affinity for those people who love righteousness and love God. And we see, we are the kind of people who see that Jesus really is the Messiah. And that's what he goes on to talk about next here. Indeed, this is the victory that is victorious over the world, our belief. And what he means by our belief is, as he's going to go on to say, our belief that Jesus is the Messiah. Who is the one who is victorious over the world but the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? John uses Son of God and Christ synonymously throughout this whole section. And I preached a whole sermon on that, so I won't get into that. But yeah, one evidence that I would cite for my perspective in that sermon was the way in which he uses these virtually interchangeably throughout this letter, really. Who is the one who is victorious over the world but the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? This man, Jesus, is the one who passed through baptism and through death. I think it's literally there, isn't it? Water and blood. I think it's water and blood throughout this whole section. I've messed with the way that I'm going to translate water and blood, but whether we talk about death or baptism or whatever, however I translate it here, it's always literally water and blood in throughout this section here. The man Jesus is the one who passed through water and through blood. Jesus is the Messiah, not either on the basis of, or we might even translate it with respect to, his baptism only, but on the basis of or with respect to his baptism and his death. Okay, what is he talking about? Well, first of all, obviously, I've taken the water to represent his baptism, and what I mean is the baptism of John, which sounds totally weird. Why would you do that? I'll explain that. And his blood as representing his death on the cross, the blood of his death on the cross. I don't know why John uses this language, why blood and water, not baptism and death. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. But I think it becomes clear finally when we understand the whole paragraph that that is what he means by this. This man, Jesus, is the one who passed through baptism and through death, and then he says, not the baptism only, but the baptism and the death. Clearly what he wants to say is, clearly what's implicit in what he's saying here is, Jesus being the Messiah on the basis of or with respect to his baptism is not particularly problematic. But what we stumble over, what we have trouble with, is seeing his messiahship in relationship to his death on the cross. That we have a problem with. Now, you and I may not have a problem with that, but John's readers have a problem with that, and indeed, I think the whole first generation of the church had a problem with that. Because they didn't have thousands of years of history of bowing down to crucifixes and having crucifixes that shine in the dark and all the other stuff that has somehow made the crucifix into a glorious and wonderful thing, full of magic and full of mystery and full of grace and so on. They had not been acculturated to that. They're facing the stark reality that the apostles are asking us, that generation, us as well, but primarily that generation, the apostles are asking that generation to confess to be the Messiah sent from God, a man who managed to get himself humiliated by being captured by the Romans as an insurrectionist and a rebel and crucified. And we're supposed to say he's the Messiah? I mean, like Kierkegaard says in Training in Christianity, it's very important that we, in facing that claim and facing the truth that we are needing to embrace, that we put ourselves in the shoes of the people who first heard that message, who are first confronted by this claim, and feel the horror of it and the shock of it and the outrage of it and the offense of it. We don't really know what we're being asked to believe until we know how ridiculous it is what we're being asked to believe. We're being asked to believe that the King of Kings and Lord of Lords over the whole world and over the whole cosmos got himself killed by these wimpy, puny little Romans. He couldn't even beat the Romans, and he's going to defeat the angelic powers, right? I mean, that's what we're being asked to believe. And so what John is saying is, it requires a certain victory over the world for you and I to come to a point where we face into that claim, as outrageous as it is, and somehow we have the perception to recognize, no, that's true. It really is true. That wasn't a defeat. That wasn't a humiliation. I mean, not in the sense that we're outraged by it. That was part of the victory. That was part of the plan. That was part of the purpose. That was part of the role and function of the Messiah sent into the world to die for the sins of the world. He's right on script. He's right on schedule. He's doing exactly what the Messiah was intended to do. But it's only by seeing that we can, in good conscience and with integrity, recognize, yes, Jesus is indeed the Messiah. And we can't see that until we think that it even makes sense for there to be someone to die for my sins. And I can't even see that until I see myself as a sinner who is really utterly depraved and unworthy of eternal life. And that's a miracle that any of us would ever have the perception of ourselves, that we are that unworthy, that we are that broken, that we are that depraved. So that's why John is saying, this is the victory, our belief, that we have confessed that Jesus is the Son of God. The Jesus I'm talking about is not the Jesus who was merely baptized by John at the baptism. The Jesus I'm talking about is the Jesus who hung there on the cross and died. That Jesus is the Messiah. Takes a miracle for any of us to believe that, if we have not been acculturated to believing it sort of facilely and trivially, if we really get the horror of it first. Okay, now, he goes on in the next section then to talk about, he's going to talk about the way in which God himself has explicitly and directly and dramatically testified to the fact that Jesus is indeed the Messiah. So he goes on, furthermore, the Spirit is the, I'm going to alter my translation slightly here, furthermore, the Spirit is the one who testifies, because the Spirit is the truth. Because there are three bearing witness, the Spirit and the water and the blood. The three do in fact, and instead of indicate, I want to make it stronger, the three do in fact establish the one claim, the one thing or the one claim. Okay, what is he talking about? Why did he go to the baptism of John as well as the crucifixion? Probably because of the history of the Gospels and the history that was passed down in tradition, people knew that something pretty remarkable happened at the baptism of John. There was a heresy later in church history where that's called a form of what they call adoptionism, where the belief was that Jesus was just a plain old ordinary human being, but God adopted this particular human being, Jesus, and that the time of his adoption was at the time of the baptism, where the Spirit came upon Jesus and basically at that point turned him into the Son of God, into the Messiah. And that same view, many people who hold that same view argued that the Spirit that adopted Jesus as the Son of God departed and left before Jesus' crucifixion, because we can't have God dying on the cross. So obviously, the Jesus who hung on the cross was no longer the Son of God. So he was only the Son of God between the baptism by John and the crucifixion. And that was declared a heresy by the church, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, there's nothing in the Bible that would give any credence to that at all. But why the baptism? I mean, why would that heresy pick that point in time to be the point of adoption? Because I think it was probably commonly recognized through traditions, as well as we see it in the pages of the Gospel, that the baptism was a really remarkable event. I didn't bring my Bible, my real Bible, so I'm going to have to do this by memory. But if you wanted to turn to John, I think it's chapter 1, verses 29 to 34, I'm going to read it out of two of the Gospels, because you have a slightly different account in John from the Synoptic Gospels. But together, they paint a pretty remarkable picture here. John was out baptizing. John 1:29. John has been baptizing, and then it says in 1:29, the next day he, John the Baptist, saw Jesus coming to him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world. This is he on behalf of whom I said, after me comes a man," is that what I want? Yeah. "After me comes a man who has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me. And I did not recognize him, but in order that he might be manifested to Israel, I came baptizing in water. And John bore witness, saying, I have beheld the Spirit descending as a dove out of heaven, and he remained upon him. And I did not recognize him, but he who sent me to baptize in water said to me, he upon whom you see the Spirit descending and remaining upon him, this is the one who baptizes in the Holy Spirit. And I have seen and have borne witness that this is the Son of God." Now, as I understand it, what John is saying is, John is a prophet, is the last great prophet in the Old Testament tradition, basically. John is his prophet, and God has revealed to him as a prophet that the Messiah is going to come during his lifetime, and he is going to be the forerunner of the Messiah and basically going to announce the Messiah to the world. How will he know who the Messiah is? Well, God has indicated that when he baptizes a person and the Spirit descends upon him like a dove, whatever that means, that when the Spirit descends upon him like a dove, that's the Messiah. Well, John has seen, has been a witness to whatever this phenomenon is that was described to him. He was a witness to that phenomenon. So God had predicted the phenomenon and then had brought about the phenomenon, thereby indicating to John, this be the man, this is the one, this is the one who's the Son of God. At Luke, or just Matthew's fine, Matthew 3, in Matthew 3:13, and all the synoptic gospels are roughly the same here, then Jesus arrived from Galilee at the Jordan, coming to John, this is John the Baptist, to be baptized by him. But John tried to prevent him, saying, I have need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me? But Jesus answering said to him, permit it at this time, for in this way it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness. Then he permitted him. And after being baptized, Jesus went up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending as a dove and coming upon him. And behold, a voice out of the heavens saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. It's easy to look at these passages and they get familiar with us, and we just kind of, there was a voice out of heaven that said, this is my beloved Son. And we don't allow it to have the appropriate impact. I mean, that was incredible. This is God directly, explicitly, dramatically, pulling out all the stops to say to the eyewitnesses there, in case there's any question, in case there's any doubt, this is God speaking. You want to know who my Messiah is? He's the one. I mean, you couldn't get clearer. You couldn't get more explicit than that. Unless you're prepared to dismiss the whole phenomenon as some kind of weird hallucination, you can dismiss the whole phenomenon. But once you grant that what you thought happened really happened, and it really is happening in objective reality, you have an explicit pointing of the finger by the God of heaven himself saying, Jesus is my Messiah. Well, that the dramatic nature of that event, the significance of that event, I think was not lost on these eyewitnesses, on the apostles, on the disciples, on the first generation. And so John is recognizing, if we want to point somewhere to some indication that Jesus is indeed the Messiah, let's start with the baptism. How do you explain that? What are you going to do with that? God said he was the Messiah. What, are we going to call him a liar? Are we going to ignore him? What's going on here? Now, but the other problem is, but this one at the baptism where a voice came out of heaven saying, this is my beloved Son, this is the Messiah, he ended up getting killed by the Romans. What's with that? Well, John says, but God testified to that as well. And there I think he has in mind an account that only John records. The Synoptic Gospels don't. But in John 12, you have another very significant event. John 12:20 through 36. It's actually 28 and 30 that I'm looking at, but let me read the larger context. John 12:20 says, now there were certain Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. These therefore came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and began to ask him, saying, sir, we wish to see Jesus. Philip came and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip came, and they told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, saying, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains by itself alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world shall keep it to life eternal. If anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall my servant also be. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Now my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify thy name. Now, this is somewhat cryptic. I think if this is all we had to go on, you know, we wouldn't really necessarily be sure what he's talking about. By the time we're done, as you will see, John makes it clear that Jesus was speaking of his upcoming crucifixion. He was about to die. So when it says his soul has become troubled, it's in anticipation of this incredible death, horrible death that he's going to have to die, that obviously he's becoming stressed by this. And so when he says, Father, glorify thy name, this is with reference to the crucifixion, his death coming up. Then notice what happens. There came therefore a voice out of heaven again. I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. The multitude therefore who stood by and heard it were saying that it had thundered. Others were saying an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice has not come for my sake, but for your sakes. Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth in crucifixion, will draw all men to myself. But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die, John says. The multitude therefore answered him, we have heard out of the law that the Christ is to remain forever. And how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? Therefore Jesus said to him, for a little while longer the light is among you. Walk while you have the light, that darkness may not overtake you. He who walks in the darkness does not know where he goes. While you have the light, believe in the light in order that you may become sons of the light. So in this context, John makes it clear that this whole conversation was in the context of what was going to happen on the cross. And Jesus describes what is going to happen on the cross with an appeal to God, God, glorify me. You have both, and the voice says, I have both glorified you and I will glorify you again, or glorify thy name. I have both glorified you and will glorify you again. How? In the crucifixion itself. So John realizes, recognizes the significance of this event. This is a voice out of heaven speaking in the context of what's about to happen with Jesus being crucified, and in effect, one more time ratifying that this man, Jesus, is playing a very unique and special role in God's scheme of things. He doesn't write out, come out and call him my beloved son in this context, or call him the Christ, but implicitly, I think it's quite clear that that's what the voice is saying. This is my son who's going to die on the cross, and this is part of the plan. So that's why John, I think, identifies the water and the blood. He really is identifying the testimony from God himself, the voice coming out of heaven saying, this is my son, both in connection with the baptism, not only in connection with the baptism, but also in connection with the crucifixion. A voice came out of heaven only three times that are recorded. The baptism, this time in John 12, and at the transfiguration. But there weren't nobody around at the transfiguration except two people. But these were the two relatively public events where a voice came out of heaven saying, in effect, this is the Messiah. So that, I think, is what John is talking about when he says, furthermore, the Spirit is the one who testifies because the Spirit is truth, because there are three bearing witness, the Spirit and the water and the blood. I think the bearing witness that he talks about is a reference to the voice of God out of heaven in the context of the baptism and the crucifixion. I haven't talked about the Spirit yet. The three do in fact establish the one claim. And I think what John is saying is, we're going to talk about what the Spirit is, but once we understand what the Spirit in conjunction with the testimony of God himself at the baptism and in conjunction with the testimony of God himself at the crucifixion, you put all three together and they all point to the same assertion. Jesus is the Messiah. And I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if the reason John picks up on these three evidences, I mean, it's not like you couldn't find a fourth evidence if you wanted to, but I think the reason he picks up on three and three evidences is, as Paul puts it somewhere in one of his letters, according to the law, anything is established by three witnesses. Isn't that right? So I think what John is saying is, by the standards of the law that God himself established, three witnesses confirming the same fact makes it a legal reality, makes it true. And if you want to follow the law in this regard, we have three witnesses. God testified once at the baptism, God testified another time later at the crucifixion, and then there's the testimony of the Spirit. Okay, what's the testimony of the Spirit? If you look at the Upper Room Discourse, where Jesus describes the coming of the Parakletos, the coming of the Spirit of Truth into the world, to make a long story short, it seems to me that Jesus describes three different functions to the Spirit in the world. One is to equip the apostles for their task and their role. He says of the apostles, the Spirit will lead you into a remembrance of all that I, Jesus, said and did, and to lead you into all truth. The role of the apostles were to be spokesmen who could actually speak for Jesus himself with respect to what is it that Jesus came into the world to reveal to mankind? What is the truth that Jesus came to reveal to mankind? You can ask an apostle and he can tell you, because they have been equipped by the Spirit of Truth to remember what Jesus taught them as they sat around the various campfires being taught. They remember what Jesus taught them objectively, and subjectively they have been led, they had their eyes and ears opened, their minds open to grasp it, to get it, to understand it. They know, and know accurately, what it is that Jesus came into the world to teach. That was one role of the Spirit of Truth. The other role of the Spirit of Truth was to work in the hearts and minds of the people that the apostles were going to testify to give them hearts and minds that were receptive to that truth. Because the apostles could understand the truth, I need a metaphor, until they were blue in the face. And it wouldn't do any good, because if it's falling on deaf ears, if people are numb to it, if they're not prepared to hear it and be responsive to it, nothing's going to happen. That's this passage we've just been talking about. There needs to be victory over the world in my heart in order for me to listen to what the apostles say and believe it. Well, that's the other role. That's the second role of the Spirit, is to open your and my hearts, give us eyes to see and ears to hear. So when the apostles proclaim their message, we don't dismiss it, but we're responsive to it, and we believe it, and we get it, and we see, we understand. That's the second role. And then there's a third role. And the third role of the Spirit is, as Jesus put it, to convict the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. Even when the Spirit does not give us eyes to see and ears to hear, we are given the subjective evidence within our own heart. I am indeed guilty. I am indeed unworthy. I'm worthy of judgment. I stand condemned because of my sin, because the standard of righteousness is above me, is beyond me. And I think every human being, we may not acknowledge it to one another, but if I'm understanding what Jesus is saying, I'm prepared to say universally that every human being, basically at the depth of their being, knows where they stand. They stand unworthy. They stand condemned. They stand guilty before God. And that's the activity of the Spirit in the world. I think what John is talking about is either one or both of those last two roles of the Spirit. The Spirit bears witness subjectively in the human heart. This is not an objective testimony, this is a subjective testimony. The Spirit of God works in the human heart to bear witness to the fact that the gospel makes sense out of my own personal subjective life. When my eyes have been opened, I look out there at the world, I look at you, I watch the way you operate, I watch what makes you tick. And this is not very flattering, but it's the truth. In my perception of things, you look pretty awful. I just don't bother to look at myself. You're selfish, you're proud, you're self-protective. You're ready to give up on righteousness and forsake righteousness if it's inconvenient. You're not like God. That's not what makes you tick. That's not what drives you. So when the Bible comes along and says all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, I'm not just believing that because the Bible said it. All I have to do is watch you. And it makes perfectly good sense to me. I think the watching you is the testimony of the Spirit. Because I have been sensitized. The Spirit of God has come into my life and given me a set of eyes that sees it that way. I believe that sees it the way it really is. Other people would say I'm utterly and completely deluded, but I believe that I'm seeing it the way that it actually is because the Spirit of truth has opened up my eyes to allow me to see that. Other people, where the Spirit of God has not given them eyes to see, they honestly don't see it. They honestly don't get it. Not that they're not, I mean, they're looking at the same evidence that I am, but their eyes don't penetrate to the depths of what drives human history and human relationships and social interaction and so on. They just don't get it. They say, in what seems like the height of naivete to me, man is basically good, but I think they really don't see it. I mean, they just honestly have that perception of things at one level. But at another level, I think they also get it and that they see somehow, somewhere, a truth that they quickly suppress, that I personally stand before God unworthy. I am not worthy of Him. Because they know that at the depth of their being, when the apostles come along and proclaim a gospel that says Jesus was God come into the world as the Son of God to die for the sins of the world, that ought to make sense to them. That ought to resonate with them because they know they are unworthy. They know they can't stand at the judgment of God on their own two feet and pass that judgment. They ought to know that. They have some sort of voice inside telling them that. So, take that person, for example. John is saying, even to the unbeliever, there are three things testifying to the Son of God. That their own inner perception of themselves that says, you are unworthy of God, and apart from the mercy of God and the provision of God, there's no way in the world that you're going to pass the judgment. Two, the baptism, the voice coming out of heaven at the baptism of God saying, this is my beloved Son. And the voice coming out of heaven when Jesus was talking about his death on the cross in a matter of days, saying, yeah, I'm going to glorify this man who's going to die on the cross. The triangulate from the three things, and what else can you conclude, John says, except that this man, Jesus, who died on the cross, he was indeed and in fact the Son of God. I'm going to run out of time here. Just quickly, I think this is a very important section for those of us who are interested in our faith and the rationality of our faith and the relationship between faith and reason. Because John is making it clear here something that just has to be the case. I mean, it just is becoming very clear to me that is the case. That it takes more than objective, historical, empirical evidence to establish the truth of Christianity in the heart of any individual human being. You also have to have it working at a subjective level. And that's as it should be. I mean, it only makes sense. Because all the objective evidence is historical evidence. It's eyewitness testimony. It's the word of other people. I mean, how do I know that voice came out of heaven and said, this is my beloved Son at the baptism? Maybe somebody made that up. I wasn't there. I wasn't an eyewitness myself. John was. So he can be convinced utterly beyond doubt in his own mind. I heard the voice, man. What am I supposed to do? I heard God tell me this was the Son of God. I don't have a choice here. That's true. John doesn't have a choice here, but I have a choice. I have a choice because I can either decide I believe John, or I could decide, you know, John's a liar. John's a fraud. And I have that option before me. There's a decision there that I'm going to have to make. What am I going to do with this eyewitness testimony about people? I don't even know them. I can't interact with them to judge their character firsthand. I do think that we can judge their character to a great degree if we study them and study the New Testaments. I think we get to know their hearts and minds and can make a character judgment to some extent. But leaving that aside, otherwise I have no basis to judge their character. So I have to fall back on something else in order to make the decision whether or not I believe in the eyewitness testimony of these people. And ultimately, that's going to have to be, well, what is it that they're claiming is the truth? Does it make any sense? They're claiming that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Does that make any sense to me? I'm going to have to decide that for myself, from my own perception, from my own judgment, from my own observation of the world. Because if what they're claiming doesn't make any sense, then I don't care how loudly they declare themselves to be eyewitnesses to this thing. I don't believe them. Nor should I believe them, really. Because if they're teaching me something that doesn't make any sense out of the reality that we all live in, then why should we listen to them? So we are not believing their eyewitness testimony just because someone came along and claimed I think they were eyewitnesses, so we should believe them. Because we hear all kinds of claims to eyewitness testimony that's spurious and funky and all kinds of stuff that I mistrust. Just because somebody says that they saw it, I don't automatically believe it, and nor should I. I have learned enough through human experience that people have agendas. People have other things operating on their perception, their interpretation of the world, their claims about the world that are not necessarily trustworthy. So just because they said it happened doesn't automatically make it trustworthy. It needs to be tested. It needs to be checked. And that's where you have the convergence of the testimony of the Spirit with the objective testimony of history and the eyewitnesses. Because the one thing I can see is one of the reasons I would say that I do believe their eyewitness testimony is because when they go on to teach me about the world and about life and about reality and about God, it passes the test of being confirmed by everything else that I can see subjectively. And why is it that I can see it? Well, according to the Bible, the reason I see reality that way is because God, through His Spirit, has opened my eyes to see reality the way it really is, and it matches everything that these apostles are teaching me about it. Okay, I need to let you have a crack at it. Maybe we can review some of this and catch any details I missed beginning next week. Questions, comments?
Well, let's see, tying in with the activity of the Spirit in the world, just have a little made-up parable. Imagine going out to a Chinese restaurant and you open up your fortune cookie at the end and the fortune said, "You will get what you deserve." It's hard to imagine somebody getting a sense of feeling good from that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good point.
I just had two things. One was in the second sentence in paragraph 35, he said you had changed the overly demanding to something, but I didn't get what you changed it to.
Basically, humanly impossible is the. I don't quite know how to translate it. I think the idea is beyond the reach of human beings, humanly impossible, something like that. That the point he's making is it. If all were well in the world, it would not even be a struggle to keep the instructions of God. But there's this other intervening reality, namely human sin, human evil, that makes what God has instructed us to do virtually out of reach to us. But, John is saying, but it's not ultimately out of reach, because every child who's been born of God has had victory over the world. So.
Okay. And the other thing was just kind of, you're saying it's easier for us to look at the cross and not be so offended because all the history is past. Would it be to think of something else, like if we'd seen the guy who claimed to be the Messiah on COPS or America's Most Wanted or something? It's like with these really...
handcuffed with his face in the mud. And, yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of thing I think of.
Yeah, exactly.
Except
Anything else?
Maybe you addressed this last week, but what is love?
Love. True love. Well, yeah, last week the way he describes it is, I mean, the standard is incredibly high, and that is, if we want to know love, let's see what God has done in and through his Son. And what the Son did is put all of the prerogatives of his role and his status aside, and as he puts it in Philippians, he became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. That is, he was even willing to give up his life for my being able to receive the mercy of God. So love is ultimately, I would define love as a commitment to work toward good, and I mean good from God's perspective and in God's sense of what's good, to work toward good in another person's life, even if I don't like them, even if I'm not going to be rewarded by that or get anything out of that from them, and even if they are unworthy of it. So it's a commitment to do good, essentially.
With this word, I thought a lot about this. The goal of love is life.
Life, okay. That the good is to promote life, real life and true life.
Yeah, and there's a couple different levels. Non-Christian people who have no concept of God or rebellious with God
seek life for people that they love in as crippled a way as that is, and yet there is something that we all long for, greater life. Not at the expense of wanting life for our kids or for people that we care about, but we also know that it doesn't end here. And it's like love really is a continuum. It just gets larger and larger and greater life. And it seems to me that people who do not have a faith in God or any notion of God just cut that short.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. There are people who could say what you just said, but I think they'd mean something radically different from what you mean. I mean, there are lots of people in this world who advocate an ethic or a philosophy that's based on the promotion of life, but what they mean by life is existence in this world. And I don't think that's love. There's nothing inconsistent with, well, I mean, Jesus himself did not promote life for himself. He promoted life for the whole world through his death. So he didn't cling to life in this world. He didn't cling to what we might call existence. He was willing to give up existence in order to lay hold of life with a capital L. I'm assuming that's the sense in which you mean life, and then I would agree. But there may very well be times where we sacrifice things of this world, things in this existence, for the sake of true life in the final age.
I was thinking about when you were talking about taking a look at Jesus' death and seeing either, you know, here's someone who claimed to be the Messiah but turned out to, you know, in a really dramatic way, be just a loser, or someone who because he truly is the Messiah, this death is his glory, you know, he's the high priest and the sacrifice, and it, you know, it means all, you know, so much to the story that God's telling. I'm wondering about people who might look at the death of Christ, maybe even at that time, in a kind of glorious way, like this was a really powerful thing, but more of the perspective of Christ was a kind of martyr, that he was promoting something that was very important, that we all should get on that bandwagon, and that in the same way that we might look at, you know, I think about like political martyrs or something of the 20th century.
Che Guevara.
Yeah, exactly, who their very death is an indication that they were right. You know, they must have been right because those in power killed them, or, you know, they bucked the system or whatever. And so we hold them up in a sense as a kind of hero. And I was wondering if you might be able to comment on the fact that some people may you know, they look at Christ as a great teacher and a great leader, and the very fact that he died a kind of martyr's death is an indication of how great he was, and we should really pay attention to him, versus him dying because he was actually the Messiah and what that meant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure what to say in response, because that's certainly logically possible. I mean, that kind of thing has happened in history. But interestingly, I'm just not aware of any evidence that was a reality back then, or that's how they perceived it. I think it's just a contingent fact that that's not what they did with it, and that nobody did that with it. You do later, you know, you have the revolt in 70 AD, and then later the Bar Kokhba revolt in about 120s, in the 120s, where the Jews come up against the Romans. But in neither case was that in Jesus' name. You know, nobody was in the name of Jesus, we defy you, Rome. That just didn't happen. I mean, to my knowledge, it didn't. And I expect that's because there wasn't anything about Jesus' teaching that would have promoted that. I mean, in the case of those martyrs where they do become the focal point and the rallying cry, they have been revolutionaries who have taught revolutionary philosophy and who have taught an opposition to a government, an opposition to a way of life. And then people continue that opposition to that way of life in their name when they have been martyred. But Jesus wasn't really, I mean, you can find anybody, any scholar today who will say anything about Jesus, and so I'm sure you can find someone who'd say that. But I just don't think that's the historical fact. Jesus didn't, there wasn't that tone or that flavor to his teaching. And accordingly, no one did that with it. Okay, I've kept you over. Thank you.